The other thing that Kishin is doing is they've sponsored conferences. We were there in 2015 for the Asian Pacific conference, which was held in Guangzhou. We had a presentation. We also participated in a pre-conference, which was very interesting to see all the many things that are being done, particularly with the support of people in Australia and Hong Kong. So there are things that have been underway for a number of years, and as I said, the situation is changing. So what are some of the challenges ahead? Well, I think broader understanding of the benefit of speech-language pathology is still needed. I think the government is beginning to understand that there's an important role for speech-language pathology in the medical world there, but trying to also let families know and individuals know that this is a service that provides you with a very basic human ability that to communicate when you've lost that ability or you have not developed that ability is a bit of it's important for individuals to understand that there is something that can be done if you have a stroke. There is something that can be done if your child is not speaking on the normal schedule. We talked about the need for appropriate and specific education aimed at speech and hearing. Certainly, there's need for tools, the assessments and intervention approaches. Continued government buy-in. The government buy-in has really what's been a primary factor in elevating what has happened. And I think collaboration with organizations and institutions outside of China will also be a key, but it has to be with the practitioners in China, as it's not going to come from outside, it's going to come from within. And I'm throwing plugs in all over the place for us, but we did, in 2017, we signed a memo of understanding with Nanjing Normal University. GW also has a memo of understanding with other universities in China, including Nanjing University. And in 2018, we set up the Nanjing Normal and George Washington University Joint Laboratory of Speech, Hearing, and Rehabilitation Sciences. And we've been conducting a series of studies, primarily in children with cochlear implants, but we're going to begin doing some work with traumatic brain injury and other areas that we think will be beneficial as research projects that will propel things forward in China and also inform us. So I want to, I have to thank the Confucius Center for its support in a lot of the things that we've done and for helping us to stay as connected and as engaged as we have been since 2014. And also the Department of Speech, Language, and Hearing Sciences, which has been supporting the center. I have to show this because this is why I went in 1996, was to meet my daughter, who is now 23 and graduated GW last year and is working in DC. So, and that's. Any questions, comments? Yes.
So, what is the role of the Chinese government in pushing those programs? Because, like, as we know, the Chinese government is super powerful and kind of.
Right.
Like to getting to everything. So
right.
Does the Chinese government also play a role in this?
Well, I think the CCCCR, which is an agency within Chinese government that has done a lot to provide support for these programs. It also is providing the therapy environments. So we work with a Jiangsu Rehabilitation Center for Children with Hearing Loss in Nanjing. And that is directly under the CCCCR. But also, provincial government has played a significant role in many of the services that are being delivered. And I think equally important with training professionals is to have the facilities that are providing the services. As we saw, most of these were not schools. they were really organizations that whose role was rehabilitation. So their role is important because they're providing the employment opportunities for those people that want to go on and become speech therapists. Yes?
How do they fix the phonetics problem? Because the Chinese phonetics is more complicated than the phonetics one.
Yeah. I want to be clear that we coming from the United States, we don't have solutions. And there are things, understanding the phonology of Mandarin is critical for professionals that are involved with speech sound correction. It's making sure that those individuals have the right kind of training so they can write down what they hear and have the right tools in order to be good analyzers of speech and language. That's really what I think is the contribution. Understanding that tools can exist for transcription, that tools exist for language analysis. Of course, all of the features of the language are going to be quite different, but at some level, there's some commonality in what's needed in order to move forward with intervention, and assessment and intervention. Yeah?
Yeah, I was actually surprised that most of the pathologists in the U.S. working in schools, so in elementary school.
That's anywhere from, in the United States, children are guaranteed that they will have services from birth to birth through basically high school.
Yeah, and so I'm just thinking if, you know, I understand there are different professional standards in China and America, you know, in terms of the pathologists, you know, their profession. I was just wondering if the two countries share the similar standards of diagnosis of like speech disorders of kids. For example, if a kid, you know, has some problem with fluency or whatever, maybe in America, they are considered as has speech disorder. However, in China, they would be considered as a problem.
Well, I think that's exactly true. That the things that would be routine here may not be either linguistically or culturally that important. So I'm glad you brought that up because I think we need to be careful in overgeneralizing what we do here. Would it be necessary to have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years of education maybe to work in every setting? I don't know, but that's the model that we have here. The model here is that of a generalist, to ensure that you have the breadth of skills to walk into any of those settings, at least initially, and have the minimum requirements that you need. But maybe that's not the best approach in another environment, in another country. So I think, you know, the point of first of all the things that we treat equivalent to the things that we treated in China? Probably not. But and with the kind of training here be appropriate in another country? I don't know if that's true either. I think that has to be determined by the country. I do know that one of the issues, we had a visit from a pediatric physician in Shanghai a couple of years ago, and she was very interested in talking to Greg Wallace, who is our autism specialist. In China, as I understand it, the diagnosis of autism would be done by a physician. And there's a tendency to over-diagnose. But largely, it would probably benefit from greater understanding of autism, better tools, and more specialization in that area. But it's one of many things that a pediatrician is involved with diagnosing. But the diagnosis comes from the pediatrician there. So I think there may be areas where there would be improvement. I think that Dr. Jean, who visited us, was concerned that there was an overdiagnosis and that maybe that situation could be improved.
So the joint lab is focusing on hearing only, right? Not
Right now, we have a number of projects that we've been working on that we're starting a project this semester where we're looking at how children with cochlear implants interact with their families and comparing that to how do hearing kids interact with their families at home. We don't really know much about, you know, what is social communication like? Is it similar or is it different? And if it's different, then what are some strategies we might take to kind of normalize that? Yes?
I think you mentioned the linguistic diversity in China, and that could be a challenge to the development of the profession. But in some sense, I guess the linguistic diversity in the US is also very, it's like a lot of diversity.
That is true.
So do you see any challenge in that aspect for your profession in the US?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, you know, the diagnosis of speech and language problems in bilingual children is, or children from monolingual, non-English speaking families. I mean, it's a very complicated issue. You know, how much exposure do they have to a particular first language or second language? And what's normal? And normal is complicated. You know, it really is related to how much exposure one has.
Do professionals in your field actually speak more than one language nowadays?
Yes, we have students in our program who will become bilingual speech language pathologists when they graduate.
Because when you go to find a doctor online, a lot of doctors list their languages that they can speak, like in Spanish or other languages.
Yeah,
So do professionals in your field have that as well?
I think they do. You know, there are some who are bilingual speech language pathologists, and that's how they're billed. That's their job in school or in the private practice. So yeah, there definitely are. I think one of the challenges is there aren't good tools there aren't always good tools in English and Spanish, for example, but there are some. I don't know that there are good tools in certain dialects of Mandarin to evaluate language, much less that language plus what might be a regional or minority language that is the first language in that child. So some of it is recognition of the fact that we're talking about bilingual kids, you know, and understanding that it's not as simple as evaluating Mandarin and saying it's deficient because there are other factors. But yeah, I don't want to suggest that we've got it nailed here because we don't. You know, when we look at dialects, when we look at different language influences, I think Fairfax Public Schools, when they have their individualized educational plan meetings, these are required by federal legislation, they have something like 68 different language interpreters who come in and talk about their and interpret these meetings. So, I mean, we have incredible
diversity. Is your hospital like 64 interpreters?
Not all at once, but if you speak Farsi, then they will have a Farsi interpreter for you.
If you request them.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I have a question.
Yeah.
More practical. For language teachers at the GW. Do you offer workshops for language teachers, you know, to give them some education, like how to, you know, help language learners in the classroom? For example, some students, I have in this method, I have a very good, very strong student who is very good in, you know, in written work, but her listening and the speaking seem to be very much slower than, you know. So, you know, I was just wondering, maybe there's a way to help, to educate, you know, language teachers to help this kind of student. At least we know what, how, when we ask them to answer questions, for example, in class or when they are doing some listening test or speaking oral test. They know, or we know how to guide them in a way.
I mean, it's an intriguing.
Their performance.
No, we haven't done that. It doesn't mean that we couldn't build that kind of relationship.
Yeah, basic knowledge.
Yeah.
That, because one day I had a student who stuttered, okay, a lot. So I don't know whether I should keep asking questions which will make him or her more nervous,
yeah.
Or should I just keep silent, or should I help him? And then I searched online about this, like, should I do this or should I do that? Then I found that actually the online information said, no, don't help out at this point, because the very act of helping can, you know, send a signal like you are impatient.
Right, yeah.
Something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Well, so I was just wondering.
I mean, I think in some areas, certainly issues of fluency or voice, you know, there are some guidance that you provide. I don't know, as one who struggles to improve my pronunciation, whether of Chinese that of Mandarin, that we would have the insight in the interface of the two languages. Because really, in most cases, that's what it is, that our first language is interfering with our ability to hear things in our second language. But we do have, as I mentioned, this accent adjustment modification program, where the goal is to better understand the two languages and what might be interfering with acquisition, with pronunciation in English, when your first language is Spanish. But I think it's intriguing because we're both involved in language teaching, just in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll bring that back to the party.
Do you have a book to recommend?
Across the board, you mean for all?
Yeah.
That would be hard to come up with, I think.
Yeah, I mean, not just particularly for Chinese, but for language educators or for language teachers. Anyway,
let me think about that, okay, because I don't want to send you in the wrong direction. But I mean, there are certainly introductory textbooks on speech impairing disorders that may cover kind of the general landscape. You know, what are these disorders? What are some strategies taken to assess and treat? It wouldn't be very deep into these, but maybe. But I'll address that.
Actually, I'm kind of interested to know about how the service framework works in China. So I'm not sure about, if from your understanding about the cost, about regarding providing those services to the people who need help with speech, language learning, and then how in China is that totally supported by the government, or does it mean the patient there? Families have to pay to receive the service, and does it suggest if the family, their income is lower, does it necessarily mean they receive less treatment or service?
Yeah. My understanding is that the services are provided by, in the case of children with hearing loss, provided by Jiangsu province. You have to bring your children to the facility, so transportation, and some families actually move from other areas in Jiangsu to Nanjing so that they can receive the services. My understanding is that they are supported by the government. We have visited the Brain Hospital in Nanjing, and there are lots of children with autism. The services there are provided by the state. But I don't know if there, as with many medical systems, there are two paths to getting services. There's the state provided, and then there is the private. And whether or not that level of service is also available if you are able to and willing to pay for them. I suspect they are, but I don't know clearly.
So actually, this is a
the question for Chinese speakers or from China. You know, everybody knows My Fair Lady and King's Speech, was that the famous, you know, movie? Is there something comparable to that in China? Any novel?
Movies or
you know, sort of
literature?
Like, yeah, so, that, yeah. Yes, I mean, speech therapy, you know, hearing and therapy within the sort of the, you know, just a, you know, general consumption, so to speak.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Any attention to that kind of thing? Because I'm just curious. Why, you know, some professionals.
I saw a documentary before. It's about the children in the rehabilitation facility. So, like, what they do, what they will be treated. And it's just a documentary.
So it was a documentary, but it wasn't a theatrical like The King's Speech or My Fair Lady or a variety of other. I mean, it's a very popular theme in American and English literature and film. I'm hoping to actually develop, once I stop chairing, I'm going to develop a course called Communication Disorders and Film. Because there are just so many references. Some of them are pretty good, some of them are horrible. You know? And but anyway, is there anything in China?
I have like a cool fact. I think I'm Korean, mm-hmm. and I watch a lot of Korean dramas and like Korean movies. And I noticed that like there's some characters in those dramas sometimes, the ones that are kind of like experience some sort of trauma, let's say, or PTSD, and they'll exhibit some sort of stutter or some sort of like speech impediment, and it's kind of clear that they, like, you know, their perception of like speech impediment and speech impediment or speech stuttering has to do with more like that trauma, like, oh, it happens to someone who experienced some sort of trauma or some kind of mental breakdown. So I think there, culturally, there definitely is different perceptions of stuttering. And even here, it might be the same, it might be different, I don't know.
There are many, many stories and dramas about traumatic experiences.
Yeah,
experiences.
Yeah,
experiences.
Yeah. They exhibit one, and I'm like, oh, I don't know if that's true, but...
Okay, thank you very much on Friday afternoon. This is wonderful. I appreciate you all sticking.